Welcome to the Thrival Festival. This is where it happens, the intersection of humans, technology, creativity. In the next three episodes, we'll be digging a little bit deeper in some of my favorite topics and themes from the 2018 edition. On the agenda, paternalism in medicine, AI applications for healthcare, and problem owners versus problem solvers. I'm your host, Karina Paraskiv, and you're listening to Healthcare Focus. One area where I think Thrival really stands out is that it's particularly good at bringing together different industries and weaving a common thread. And so throughout the day, you heard things about data dilemmas, ethics, inclusive designs, tech audits and disruption, the fourth industrial revolution. And it crossed a number of different angles that we're perhaps used to seeing, like smart cities, body hacking, UN strategies and education. But the fact that they were all together under this one roof really made a lot of cross-pollinization possible. And so that's the general expectation when you do step onto any of these Thrival conferences or talks that are happening there. But it turned out, and that really surprised me, that you could also dive really deep into your own industry. And that's as much in terms of the topic as the people who are actually at the conference and that you get to encounter. And I think that's very rare to find in a conference, right? It has as much breadth as it has depth. And what I've done is actually go into these niche topics and explore that even further, drill down in good Chatham House rule style, by taking one quote that really struck me and building around that to understand a little bit deeper what was meant. And so today's episode, we're looking at the following quote: "Medicine has been shifting from paternalistic care to participative care." And this was said as one of many great points on the stage during a biohacking talk. But I wanted to take a moment and really dive a little bit deeper in this tradition and this shift that's happening and understanding a little bit why it's actually interesting and not self-evident. "1874, Code of Medical Ethics of the American Medical Association. The obedience of a patient to the prescriptions of his physician should be prompt and implicit. He should never permit his own crude opinions as to their fitness to influence his attention to them. A failure in one particular way may render an otherwise judicious treatment dangerous, even fatal." Fast forward to today's code of ethics. The patient has the right to make decisions regarding the healthcare that is recommended by his or her physician. Accordingly, patients can accept or refuse any recommendation for medical treatment. So you see that there's a very big shift there in between the different eras, I guess. And obviously, the patient's informed consent in 1950s really was one of those turning points. But when you look at these things, there's a tendency to really see polar opposites, to believe that there's on one hand the paternalistic care and on the other end the participative care. And this is where it gets interesting, because if you look at how the American Medical Association talks about these, it's not as black and white. So there's definitely, there are two dimensions to this. There's definitely a spectrum that goes from what we call patient autonomy, that's the patient-centered care, to the other end, which is benevolent paternalistic medicine. So that's basically the patient as a decision maker versus the doctor as a decision maker. But the MAMA came in 2006 with, actually they copyrighted, a doctor-patient model that went back to 1956, and they're filling in those missing steps, right? So they talk about on one end the mutual participation, to guidance or cooperation, to activity-passivity, and that last one is really what we call the paternalistic medicine. And it becomes interesting because when you're looking at the clinical applications, you actually realize that they don't prescribe one or the other more than the other. It's really they tell you it's good for certain specific conditions, right, or certain situations. So for example, if you're looking at mutual participation, that's what we would call the patient-centered care. You would think, okay, chronic illnesses, psychoanalysis. If you're looking at guidance cooperation, that's somewhere where, unlike the previous one where the doctor was basically helping the patient so that he could make his own decision, this is somewhere where the doctor tells the patient you should be doing XYZ. And we're dealing with acute infections, processes, and so on. And when you dive into what we call activity passivity, that's the benevolent paternalistic medicine, we're looking at situations where the person is under anesthesia, where they may have had acute trauma, they may be in a coma and unable to make a decision, they might be delirious. So it really brings this into perspective. And more than that, even when you do take something like the benevolent paternal medicine, you're not just looking at the doctor making a decision no matter what. You can even have gradations in that end of the spectrum. So for instance, there's a difference between a doctor that says, I know what's best for the patient no matter what, and a doctor that would say, if the patient does not demonstrate that they actually have researched thoroughly their position and that it's really something they've reflected on, then I know what's best for them and I will enforce it. But if they do come with some kind of rationale, even though it may not be the same values or the same priorities that the doctor's has, then the doctor might say, okay, that person did do their due diligence. They are having what we call informed consent. Therefore, I will let them pick the outcome that they chose. So even at that end of the spectrum, doctor knows best can also have different shades there. So if you're looking at the emic view, all of this, what we're seeing is that the autonomy actually is linked to a lot of different principles of medical laws and ethics. On the one hand, you have beneficence, right? So everything we do in medicine, we do it for the benefit of the patient. And there comes a point where the workload becomes an issue, because if you have time to really know the person, then you might understand the subtleties and perhaps what might be best for them. But otherwise, you're basically working under very big time constraints with general statistics. And so there is one point to be made here in terms of how much can we really know what's best for a patient if we don't have the time in our schedule to really address and get to know them. The second level is the decision-making capacity. And for this, I'll also talk about the surrogate decision-making capacity. So on the one hand, there's the cognitive level. So like we've said, if you're in some kind of trauma situation, you can't really make a decision. If you're an infant and you can't make a decision, at some point someone has to step in and make the decision for you, right? But even if you are having fairly good cognitive functions and you're able to really understand the treatments, you as a person might actually have preferences that vacillate over time. So your inability to really stick with one point of view or one preference over time might make it difficult if a doctor were to take the patient-centric approach to the extreme and cater to changing desires or needs. And if you step out, though, from this picture and look at it from a broader perspective, there comes a question of burden, because eventually it is about the right and the privilege to make a decision, but it's also about the burden, like who is going to take the responsibility for this. And in many cases, it's divided between either the patient, the family, the doctor, or a combination of the three. And it's not something that's always desirable, and sometimes we forget that. So some patients are very proactive and they want to take the lead on their health. They come into the office, they've researched their diseases, they're very, very proactive in that sense. And other patients may not have the time, they may not have the resources, there might be a lot of things going on, or they might not have the knowledge or the capacity to really understand very intricate details. So they might say, I prefer that someone with the authority and the knowledge take the decision for me. So it's very interesting to see that sometimes that burden, it's not just a question of whether the doctor wants or not to have the patient involved. There's also a question on the other side of whether that patient wants to be involved as well in that same capacity. There's a question about disclosure. So this is where it gets really interesting, and where I would actually question something. There is a book that was written not long ago. It was called The Good Doctor. And this is where a young practitioner who has a dad who was also, his father was also a doctor, writes about the differences between the generations. And he says, at the time, my father sometimes did not tell someone who was terminally ill that that was their condition, that they were going to die and that there was nothing they could do to save him. And he sustained the argument that because he knew the family very well, or he knew the patient for so long, he knew that that was deep down the thing that they would have wanted, right? To not be told that it's all over, and to still like give them peace of mind in a sense as they continue. And he was appalled by that, the young physician, because he said, no, it's mandatory to fully disclose things. And One of the things I came across when I was looking at genomics research was, okay, but do we always want to know everything? Because there's also something to be said about the fact that if I can pick up on something that a condition that you have, or maybe even genes, that in 20 years from now something will happen, but there's nothing you can do about it, does it really enrich your life that I tell you this? And so that question of disclosure is also interesting when it comes to that. Then there's the futile treatment, which has to do a lot with the payment model. So when it's a patient-centered care, we also have to wonder something in regards to how does that affect the system? Because if every patient gets to pick what they want, the way that they want it, and it's participative to the extent where the patient becomes almost the decision maker, there's no incentive to think about the system as a whole. And so part of the mechanisms that exist today, like the copays and the high deductibles, are there to help incentivize the patient to also think twice about some of the requests he's having. But nevertheless, it still is something that the more you go towards that end, the more you're dealing with the systemic problem of limited resources and how are you going to actually share them across the different people who have different needs. And that's the polar opposite, obviously, of a doctor when in a situation where this is really one decision maker that can have more control over the system and the resource that we share. And the last point that I want to bring here, which is also interesting when you're looking at whether it makes sense to have patient autonomy versus paternalistic medicine, is this idea of malpractice. There's a danger when we go to the patient-centered mindset, right, to become what they call the servile technician. So that's basically all care, no responsibilities. And there were studies that were done, and it was quite interesting when you're looking at the figures, because you realize a lot of the treatments that were prescribed were not necessarily things that the doctors wanted to prescribe, but they were things that they actually felt pressured to prescribe. So if we're looking a little bit at the numbers, we were looking at 500 doctors, and 83% of them had prescribed or carried out treatment that they actually did not believe were pertinent for the patient. And 60% of the doctors, when they were polled, said that they actually went ahead and did that because they were concerned about basically getting sued, about the fact that there was a lot of pressure from the patient, and so they went against their professional judgment to please and back themselves up from the patient. And in something very similar, when you're looking at the Royal College of Surgeons, they actually changed their statements and the approach that they're having, where after being sued for £5 million because a baby was born with disabilities and the mother said she hadn't been advised properly in regards to the risks and so on, they've actually put out a new statement that said, we're going to step away from paternalistic attitudes and we're going to let the patient decide what's best for them. So we give them information and they are liable to make their own decisions. So there's definitely an economic argument that comes into the picture, and it may not be the right argument, right, to go towards patient-centered care, but it's nevertheless one of the factors that perhaps has tilted a little bit the balance in that favor. After looking at all these angles, it quickly becomes apparent that you can't have a dogmatic position on this question. There's really a context under which to look at both the paternalistic approach, which has its place, and the patient-centered care, which also has its place. Now, an interesting thing to bring into the discussion is this idea of payment, and we touched a little bit about it right before when we were looking at ethics, but it's interesting to push the idea a little bit further when you're looking at it in terms of ecosystem. We've seen a lot of different things come up when it comes to being more efficient and improving the payment situation there in that sphere. Continuous quality improvements, managed competitions, paying for performance, consumer-directed health plans, medical homes, and accountable care organizations under Obama. So a lot of these trends are trying to find a solution to the rising costs of healthcare, to the fact that the population is aging, and so on and so forth. And one additional trend, which changes a little bit this whole discussion is this idea of mergers and acquisitions, which there have been a lot in the past few years. And why is this relevant? When you're talking about patient-centered care, and you're looking at empowering the patient to be autonomous and make their own decisions, you're also saying that the patient can have a say in the treatment that he chooses, more so than in a paternalistic model. Now, this can actually be counterproductive in a system where the incentives are not aligned for this. What ends up happening is that when you give a choice to the patient and you're being, encouraging of patient autonomy, over one quarter of the patients actually decide to forego surgery when they're better informed. And the tricky part of this is that if you're going for elective surgery, then you're not really bringing in that much money if you're only rewarding doctors for providing more care, so to speak, rather than that better care. And this is true, but it's true only in situations where the insurer is not integrated with the delivery system. In other words, this used to be true in a landscape where hospitals were functioning in one way and insurers were, a distinct entity, and there was no correlation between the two. But once you see healthcare networks coming together, and often through mergers and acquisitions, having both the delivery side and the insurer sides, that's when it becomes really interesting, because offering to the patients more information and letting them choose of their own volition reduces the risk of legal pursuits, which is a first benefit of this action, but it also enables costs to go down, because suddenly having a non-intrusive treatment, which is usually typically what the most patients end up choosing, ends up less costly for the system as a whole. And so that's really one other game changer I would highlight, which also brings a different perspective to this discussion, because sometimes it's not just about the dogmatic position that you may have regarding whether we should be paternalistic or user or patient-centered, but there's also this added layer of who pays for this and how are these incentives allowing you to do either one or the other type of care. Okay, last little bit here. I want to look at two things, internet and genomics. So you probably know this instinctively, but just in case, there's studies about this too. Patients, a lot of them, Google things on internet. They even talk about Dr. Google. So here's one finding from one research, but of course different researchers will tell you something different, so have a look at our show notes if you want to see what this particular one was set up as and so on. 60 to 80% of the internet users have actually used it to find health information. So that could be trying to figure out if the diagnosis they have is correct, or to self-diagnose, or trying to research medication information. And it turns out that two-thirds of the doctors in this research actually found the information to be somewhat reliable. And this is interesting because on the one hand, the patient is being very involved, and that's exactly what we mean by having a patient-centric model in terms of medicine. But the doctor-patient trust can actually undergo some level of erosion, because the patient is now armed with a lot of knowledge, but he doesn't have the schooling or the experience that the doctor has. And so sometimes that can actually create a difference, a divergence in opinions. It might also be that they look up really niche things that the doctor maybe isn't specialized in. And the problem here is that the patient has always been able to switch doctors, basically, so to walk away and find another provider. But now there's this added pressure because he's got the extra information and he's now evaluating his doctor, which perhaps he was doing a little bit less in the past. But at the same time, this brings a challenge, because the patient comes with a lot of information, not necessarily the background knowledge to really interpret and understand it, and now the doctor has to take extra time to review these things, to correct and educate in terms of the information found, and perhaps back up and justify some of his decisions. And that's time that may be not built in right now in the system to adequately discuss this. And I think one of the biggest things that you see there, and that also drives us to the next topic, is there was actually the MEA published an article in last September that was called "Your Patient's Asking About Her 23andMe Results, Now What?" And I think this really shows just how far this trend is going, if even the MEA is talking about this, right? So this brings us to the genomics topic as a side note too. When you're looking at personalized medicine, you're looking at collecting data, and you have to have a large amount of it for it to be meaningful, but you're also looking at lifestyle data points and other contextual information like the environment and the stress factors and whatnot. And this whole data collection is really interesting because in both cases, they're really the patient's data, right? They're data that they might be collecting themselves through devices that they own at home, like a Fitbit and so on. Or it might be just DNA, things that is in their body, but you can't really take without their consent. And so under the current legislations, both of these scenarios involve active consent and actually active participation from a patient so that you can gain this data. But the balance of powers then is really shifting, because previously we could decide that it would just be a paternalistic model and that the patient would not necessarily be involved in decision-making. But this only works to a certain extent, because as soon as you actually require information and data from the patient, you need his buy-in. And so this changes a little bit the dialogue and the interaction between the patients and the health institutions. So suddenly the doctors need the patient just as much as the patient needs the doctors. Some patients may want a paternalistic style. So as we've seen, sometimes it's about, ability to make decisions and really know what's best for you. Maybe you don't feel confident about that as a patient, but there's also a cultural component. So it's been shown that in Latin America and in Eastern Europe, having a patient-centric model sometimes was detrimental, because the expectation and the way people were really, the need they were expressing was more towards paternalistic care. And at the same time, some of them may want to be active participants. And so having a system where they're not able to come in and share the data that they found, having access to all these technologies, that may actually be something that harms the patient compliance and the participation and the fact that they remain with that specific doctor instead of switching. So the trend is definitely undeniable. But it turns out that it might actually be a pendulum that will eventually come back in the middle. So as it's gone to one extreme with paternalistic care, perhaps now we're exploring the other extreme because of liabilities and so on, and malpractice suits, where we're really being very patient-centered. And maybe somewhere in between those two extremes, based on the different contexts and the different needs, we'll find just what the right way to interact with each patient with their own needs and their own preferences and their own situations might be, so that we can deliver the best care. You've been listening to Healthcare Focus, and this episode is actually part of a three-part series on the Thrival Festival. So the next two episodes, we're diving into two other big themes from the 2018 edition, and that is the AI and data biases, except we're going to look at it not from a broad perspective, but specifically what it means for healthcare, what we should be paying attention to, and how do we actually pursue the tradition of ethics that exists in the healthcare industry now that new technologies are entering the field. And we're also going to explore something that is quite an interesting concept that they brought forward. So they were mentioning, how our society has so many problem solvers and how that there's really a premium on creative problem solving. But what if what we really needed was a problem owner? So that's up next on Healthcare Focus. In the meantime, do check out Thrival's website. It is thrivalfestival.com. If you actually add /speakers at the end of this, you can check out some of the people that were on stage this year. And they include a lot of brands and names that you know, but it's very interesting because the people speaking are really the innovators in those companies, right? So we're looking at UPMC, Duolingo, Dell, PNC, Google AI, and also, of course, our two big universities here. So University of Pittsburgh and CMU, which is the university I'm part of. And I think just as a general trend, you'll be able to see, scanning through the different topics that they were having this year, it gives you a very good pulse of what's going on in the market in fields that are maybe different from your own and even in your own. So that's quite an interesting money spending exercise to do. The registrations won't be up for a little while. The event happens in early fall, but do stay tuned. It's definitely an event that is worthwhile here, right here in Pittsburgh. So until next time, have a great week, and we'll see you on our next episode of Healthcare Focus.